if the Trump administration knew how to get out of its own way. They've had 4 years, 4 months, 5 months in office, and they still haven't really negotiated anything. They're not very good at this.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is Justice by Design, where I talk to solution finders with respect to some of the biggest issues facing us as a society and as a global community. I don't know if you're old enough to remember the Daisy ad. If you're not, I'll include a link to it in the show notes. It was a campaign ad that ran just once in 1964, featuring a little blonde girl picking the petals of a daisy, counting down, not entirely correctly because she looks to be only about 3 years old. But at the end, there is an exploding nuclear plume, something that was meant to catch the attention of Americans. And it did. It did a lot more than simply help path the way to an election win for Lyndon B. Johnson. It ushered in the nuclear age in a way that Americans could comprehend. And it also led to measures being taken over the decades after to prevent a nuclear fallout. Well, are those things still holding today? Is the nuclear threat of the past in the past? Or is it growing more than ever? And what can we as Americans do about it? These are big questions, and that's why I am so glad today to be joined by John Wolfsall, who is the Director of Global Risk at the Federation for American Scientists. John, thank you so much.
Kimberly, thank you so much for having me.
And also, everyone should check out, also in the show notes, a piece in the Washington Post that John and his colleagues at the Federation wrote that is called Why We Should Worry About Nuclear Weapons Again. And that's why, that is where I will start, John, is the why. What is the current nuclear reality? I mean, in the past, I would think about it as a race between the United States and Russia. But I know that has changed. Where do we stand right now?
I'm thrilled to be here, Kimberly, because a big part of what we do is try to just share basic information about the status quo. I have the luxury or the curse of thinking about these things on a daily basis. And we know most people don't spend their time thinking about how many nuclear weapons are there in the world and who has them. And so just providing that is a big part of what FAS is about. Today, there are 9 countries in the world that have nuclear weapons. The United States and Russia are the 2 largest nuclear weapon states. We have between 3,700 and 4,500 weapons each, and that's about 90% of the world's nuclear arsenal. But there are 7 other countries, France, Britain, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea, all of whom are known to have nuclear weapons and have conducted nuclear tests or are thought to have done so. It's interesting you mentioned the Daisy ad because you can get lost in those numbers. There are about 12,000 nuclear weapons in the world today. Each one of those weapons are massively larger than the weapons that were dropped in 1945 in Japan. Each one of them are city killers. And so if you run down the list of cities in the world and you put one weapon to each large city, and then you go to the next largest one and the next largest one, you're eventually bombing cities that have like 10,000 people in them. Like, these are the tools with which humanity could destroy itself. And that's the focus of the piece, which is talking about the reality that these weapons never went away. We felt after the Cold War, after the Soviet Union collapsed, that we would make progress on eliminating these weapons and that people recognized that they were essentially useless because they were the tools of our own destruction. And what has changed is, quite frankly, the mindset of the leaders in those countries that have weapons, that they now increasingly view these weapons as usable, either politically, that they can be used to achieve political gains, or that we could conceivably use a weapon or two, as Vladimir Putin has threatened to do in Ukraine, or the United States has threatened to do in, say, the defense of Taiwan, and that that wouldn't spread, that that wouldn't lead to large-scale nuclear war. And that is the fantasy that we left behind during the Cold War that has come back with a vengeance and threatens, quite frankly, to put the entire human race at risk?
So let me drill down on that a little further, because I always understood nuclear weapons to be a deterrent factor. You know, it's mutually assured destruction, and so it is meant to prevent conflict. You're saying that that is no longer the case today.
So the dominant theory is that we never had a nuclear war when there were multiple nuclear states, because we developed the ability to ride out or suffer a nuclear attack and have enough to respond. And Russia eventually did the same, and China eventually did the same, and most of the other countries have as well. If that were a perfect world and everybody believed that, you might be able to have some confidence that we wouldn't destroy ourselves. But that assumes that human beings, and I don't know how many human beings you know that meet this criteria, get every decision right every time. We make lots of mistakes in the nuclear world, and we could talk about some of those. They are enough to turn your hair white. People no longer believe that mutually assured destruction is a thing that everybody believes in. If your leadership is not rational, mad doesn't apply, right? If you're insane or drunk or prone to emotional outbursts, and I don't know any leaders like that myself, then can you rely on mad? We've seen not just Russia, but the United States and North Korea and other countries, Pakistan, say, if we get attacked, we're going to use these things. They are not just a deterrent against other types of nuclear weapons, but they're also used to deter conventional attack. So if you're the first to use a nuclear weapon in a conventional attack, that means you don't think your adversary will retaliate. And you very quickly end up on a ladder of escalation where you're trying to outdo the other side, which, in my opinion, quickly rides up the level to much broader conflict and nuclear exchanges.
So I want to get to those mistakes, but I first want to drill a little more, because one question that came to me this morning was, you know, we always make the joke that, oh, you know, this guy has will get a hold of the nuclear codes and you know, just to sort of to say that this is a warning. But here we are. We have people more than in several of the nuclearized countries that you mentioned, who may not be seen as the, you know, most clear thinking, you know, intentional, you know, carefully reasoning people who you would want in control of nuclear arsenals. How does that affect the risk that we face today?
You're being much more diplomatic than I usually am. we have a president who in his first term got into a shouting match with Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, and said, my button's bigger than yours, and my weapons work, and we're not so sure yours do, and you better fall in line. Now, of course, he then famously courted him, and they exchanged, quote, love letters back and forth. Yeah. But I don't think any of the leaders today are necessarily irrational. They have logical needs and wants. They just don't always match up. And so what we really worry about in most of these situations is the mismatch in capability. Does Vladimir Putin view the conquest of Ukraine as an existential issue for him? Is he prepared to bring down not only all of Russia, but the entire world in order to achieve that? We don't know. He tries to project that he is. Is North Korea prepared to go down swinging with nuclear war if they feel they're being attacked? Maybe. The real concern is not that countries will wake up and be like, oh, today I feel really good about launching a nuclear war today. Like, could that happen? There is a risk. And we do worry about should the president or anybody have the sole authority to launch nuclear weapons. What we really worry about is that in the fog of war, leaders will misunderstand what's happening. And they will think a strategic attack is imminent or actively happening and respond asymmetrically. So for example, we've had episodes in the United States where our training tapes were put into the computer systems that showed full-scale nuclear attacks being launched at the United States. The president was woken up in the middle of the night because they thought that there was an attack incoming, and it turned out to be false. We have false alarms like that during peacetime pretty regularly, like every couple of years. So imagine, for example, in the middle of a conventional shooting war, like in South Asia, which we just had, right? India and Pakistan were just going back and forth. There was a lot of disinformation and misinformation about where those attacks targeted at Pakistan's ability to launch nuclear weapons. They are paranoid that their leadership will be decapitated. Some of the strikes were near Pakistani nuclear facilities. And so in that environment, can things escalate quickly? And that is where we worried about not just the rationality of the leadership, but how in control and how confident they are in their ability to maintain their own survival.
So I want to talk a little bit about the tools that exist for reducing the nuclear threat. And I want to talk about a country that you did not list, but that has been the subject of a lot of this, which is Iran, who the last I checked was some weeks away from the ability to create a nuclear capable weapon. But for a long time, there was an agreement about the nuclear use. That agreement has been in effect and out of effect over time. But what, if anything, can agreements and treaties do to reduce the risk of the sort of nuclear threat that we're talking about?
So interesting, you mentioned the Iran deal. I worked in the Obama administration and helped actually negotiate that agreement. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. It does get to this larger point, which is there are some people who think the only way you prevent nuclear war is by being ready to fight one. And that if your adversary is building up, the only way you can demonstrate that they won't get ahead of you is to get ahead of them. Mm. That's the logic that led the United States and the Soviet Union to build, and I'll speak very clearly, 70,000 nuclear weapons together during the Cold War. At the height of the Cold War, their stockpiles included 70,000 nuclear weapons, everything from long-range strategic bombers and missiles to nuclear backpacks and anti-ship mines and landmines that could be carried by one or two people. So there are some people who think that that's the only way you'll ever develop security. I think that's a flawed logic. We've seen that play out in the past, and I think that's where we would go if we apply it again. The only way you can convince countries that a nuclear war is not worth having and won't be had is by engagement. And that is hard. You don't trust that your adversary will necessarily do the right thing or abide by their agreements. You negotiate an understanding about what weapons are for, when they will be used, when they won't be used. And then you build verification provisions that allow you to understand exactly what your adversary has and what they don't have. So, for example, the United States and Russia have an agreement. It's not fully enforced. Russia has violated some of its terms. The United States has responded. But it was negotiated in 2010. It's called the New START Treaty. And it says neither side will have more than 1,550 strategic offensive weapons. And we used to have Russian inspectors that came to U.S. missile bases and submarine bases and bomber bases. And we did the same in Russia so that we knew we didn't have to plan against an adversary with 10,000 weapons or 20,000 weapons. When you don't have access and you don't have transparency, the U.S. and other countries tend to rely on worst-case planning. And so until you can agree that these weapons themselves should be eliminated, and most people recognize that as the long-term goal and something we should work toward, you're going to need to cap them and control them. And right now, the world is moving in a very different direction. But we have the tools. We know how to do this. It is a matter of political will. The problem is right now, the political will is on the side of nuclear competition to outdo the other side and to outrace as a sign of our true commitment and our strength. And again, we saw that movie play out in the 1960s and 70s. I didn't really care for that. And I'm not planning to pay money for the sequel.
Yeah. So how on the issue of transparency, how much transparency do we have even in the American nuclear arsenal and also in the nuclear arsenals of other countries?
So we haven't worked that closely together. So I know that's not a loaded question, but it just so happens the organization, which I help to support and be part of, is the world's best, most reliable source of unclassified information about nuclear arsenals in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to do, but we rely on open source information, satellites, government statements, past intelligence reports that get declassified. Before I got there at the Federation, estimated the U.S. nuclear arsenal. In 2010, I think it was, the Obama administration, for the first time in many years, unclassified the total number of weapons we had. And the Federation of American Scientists estimate was off by less than 3%. So we're pretty good. Not perfect. by any means, but we could bound the problem. We have a little bit less confidence in our ability to do that for Russia, China, North Korea, but you can get a fairly good sense of how these countries operate their nuclear weapons. If they test nuclear weapons, we can detect that rather quickly. We have agreements and capabilities in place. So you can bound the problem, but it is much easier to do if the countries cooperate and exchange data, if they are somewhat transparent, maybe not like this weapon is located in Des Moines, Iowa on Tuesdays, but we have this many submarines, we have this many missiles, or we intend to limit our arsenal to 3,000 weapons or 5,000 weapons. So you can have a pretty good sense. Now, the U.S. government is much better than that. I won't say how much better, but when I was in the U.S. government, I was pleasantly pleased that our time and money in the intelligence community was spent very well understanding the nature of the nuclear threats against us. I don't know how strong that investment is today. The Trump administration has undervalued those issues, but we have a pretty good sense of where the weapons are and who has them.
So then what would be the next step, do you think, in de-escalation of the nuclear threat then? Would it be encouraging more of the agreements that we've seen in the past? What are the next steps that you think the government ought to be taking?
So in the piece that came out in the Post, we talk about the fact that this is not a two-country problem or a three-country problem.
Right.
This is a nine-country problem, and there are no easy solutions. What everybody agrees on is that as the two largest nuclear weapon states, the United States and Russia, have to stay within some agreement about how many nuclear weapons they'll have, to be transparent about that, and to refrain from threatening to use these weapons. If we don't have that, it's very hard to get traction on any of these other issues.
Yeah.
China has roughly 600 nuclear weapons. The United States has almost 4,000. But China is increasing its arsenal. It looks like they're going to go to about 1,500 weapons, roughly twice what they have now in the next 10 years. It'll still be half of what the U.S. has, but they're entering that area where they could be peers. So they've said consistently, we're not going to lock in our numbers until you, the big guys, come down to our level. So if we want to lower the number of nuclear weapons, the U.S. and Russia have to engage in that conversation. Interestingly, Trump could do that, right? He said he wants to negotiate a deal. Putin, I think, would love a deal.
I mean, that's what I was going to say. I mean, you mentioned, you know, Trump and Kim Jong-un's bromance that took place in the first term. Trump usually, I guess it depends on the week, but usually claims a pretty strong relationship with Vladimir Putin. Is this an area where that could actually be beneficial?
So it could be if the Trump administration knew how to get out of its own way. They've had 4 months in office, and they still haven't really negotiated anything. They're not very good at this. Interestingly, even people like me who think that the Trump administration is moving in the wrong direction on a lot of different issues have written out exactly how they could do this. The United States and Russia could agree in the next several months to a new deal because the current deal expires in February of next year, at which point then the United States and Russia will have no limits on the number of nuclear weapons they could have.
Wow.
And both sides could build up rather quickly. The deal is there for the taking. It could take the old numbers under the New START treaty and extend them. They could go down to lower levels. The United States only needs a lot of nuclear weapons to deal with Russia and China. We have plenty to deter them. They know that we could respond to any attack. And so that deal is there for the taking. And if so, then you could get some traction on the other issues. Now, the United States has to do multiple things at once, however. It has to negotiate a deal with Iran to prevent new nuclear weapon states from emerging. As you said, Iran is perhaps weeks away from building a weapon. They have enough material in hand now for 10 weapons. So in the next year, they could become a pretty significant nuclear threat. India and Pakistan have to negotiate. They've never done so without the United States being directly involved. The U.S. had to insert itself into the recent crisis to try to tamp that down. There's an opportunity between Trump and Kim Jong-un if they want to take it, although Kim Jong-un now has a buddy in Vladimir Putin as well because of the war in Ukraine. So all of this is to say, I don't have a short, pithy answer for how to do this. There are steps the U.S. should and could be taking, and unfortunately, we're not because it has not been prioritized by this administration. All of the effort we're spending, in fact, on tariffs and travel bans, could in fact be spent on keeping our allies from thinking about building their own nuclear weapons. But I worry, and we have another piece coming out in a few weeks in the Post, this is part of a series, that talks about how many nuclear weapon states we could have in 10 or 20 years if we keep heading down the path we are. And it's not a pretty picture.
So this is a perfect segue to what I will call the Black Mirror part of our discussion, which is all the things that I worry about. And one of them is AI, the increasing use of AI when it comes to managing nuclear arsenals. How worried should I be about this?
So interesting you should ask. We're actually running a project right now. It's almost as if you read my mind, looking at whether and how AI is being integrated into what's called nuclear command, control, and communications. These are all the different systems that enable us to safely maintain and, if necessary, God forbid, to order the use of a nuclear weapon. Interestingly, most of America's nuclear arsenal is about 20 or 30 years old. We built this stuff in the 1980s and 1990s, and so it's really not ripe for rapid integration with large language models and advanced AI systems. Some of the systems, like our early warning, how we detect the launch of an incoming missile, are actually using artificial intelligence already and have actually for a while. They are very good at taking large amounts of data and analyzing it and giving you predictions about what's going to happen. And so in some areas, we are using automation. We have a strong track record and it works pretty well. Where people are quite nervous, however, is the idea that automation or artificial intelligence should be used in any way, shape, or form to decide when nuclear weapons will be used. This idea of decision support or decision delegation. The United States and China and the UK and France have all said, we oppose the automation of nuclear decision-making and that a human should not only be in the loop, but they should have effective control over nuclear decisions. Russia, interestingly, has never made that pledge. They do rely on automation. So I would say it is something to think about, and it's something for us to be mindful of, but it's not going to happen in the next couple of years. What you should worry about, and this is where geeks like me make their money, currently there is no guidance inside the U.S. government to decide when AI and nuclear weapons will be mixed or not. And that's a recipe for ad hoc decision-making. Individual generals, individual assistant secretaries of defense get to decide whether this is a good idea or not. And what we actually need is some standard that's tested against risk and alternatives before we integrate AI into more parts of nuclear command and control. And that's one of the things we try to work on.
And how much I keep reading about how the current administration has people in multiple roles, you know, like Secretary Marco Rubio and others. You have people who have both jobs within the Pentagon and in other agencies. Mm-hmm. How big of a problem is that sort of garbled command at a time, you know, I'm thinking here, the Pentagon is having trouble just keeping helicopters out of the path of landing planes at DCA here in Washington, D.C. How confident can we be that there are clear protocols being made to determine the command, who's in charge, and how things like AI might be implemented?
So on the AI integration, I do worry because without that guidance, I think you could see a lot of ad hoc decision making, a lot of sort of instinct as opposed to what are we actually doing here and what's the risk? Now, fortunately, and I am a nuclear skeptic, I'm generally not invited to a lot of dinner parties at Stratcom or at, you know, the nuclear planning group inside the government. But I have worked very closely with U.S. Strategic Command and the Pentagon military and civilians that work this issue. They are very good at what they do. Okay. They are very conservative by nature. And there are very clear protocols that are in place to ensure that the United States will never launch a nuclear weapon unless the president authorizes it. And also that if the president does order the use of a nuclear weapon, that that order can be effectively implemented. Now, the problem, in my view, and I've written about this in the past, is no one person in any country, whether it's Donald Trump or Joe Biden or Barack Obama or Harry Truman, should be able to decide to start a nuclear war. It's very different if the United States is under attack. If we've been hit by nuclear weapons, if our allies have been launched, hit by nuclear weapons, there are time pressures and the United States needs to have the ability for the commander-in-chief to respond appropriately, and that in a democratically elected system, that's the president's call. But on a Tuesday, if Donald Trump or Joe Biden were to wake up and say, you know what, Iran's really a problem for me, I want to launch a nuclear weapon, there is no time pressure. That's a choice. Should the president on his own be able to do that? And I've argued for many years, and we've done a lot of work on this at the Federation, that in fact, there should be laws in place that require the president to consult with and gain the authorization from other legal entities, whether it is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the Secretary of Defense, the Speaker of the House as third in line to the president, to start a nuclear war. The Constitution gives the Congress the authority to declare war. And given the stakes of starting a nuclear war, it seems reasonable that you'd want to have more than one person in the chain of command. Right now, the president can take the code that he holds with him at all times, get on a telephone to the Pentagon, verify that he is who he says he is, and say, I want to launch a nuclear weapon at Russia or China or North Korea or pick your country. And the military officer on the end of that phone call can be told, don't talk to anybody else. Don't talk to your commanding officer. I want you to communicate this order. I don't want to talk to anybody else. And you better execute now. And they have a legal obligation, as long as it's a legal target, to execute. And that's not a democratic system. And that's not one that people should feel comfortable with.
So what can we do? I mean, aside from the excellent work that you and the other folks at FAS are doing, is there something that the public can do here? I mean, I feel like every week I say, you know, call your lawmakers and let them know. But especially given the fact that there is so much going on right now in this year, 2025, and there are a lot of things that Americans are worried about, and it's only so much bandwidth we have, I think that's probably unlike the past. That's one reason why the DAISY ad was so effective, right? Was because it caught the attention of the American electorate. What can we do in a digital age to get that same message across? So I'm asking about two things. One, just making Americans aware of this growing threat. And two, urging something be done about it. How should that look?
I don't have the answer to that. It's one of the things we work on consistently, and it is hard, right? I mean, look, we're all inundated every day. Like, I'm not immune from this.
And me neither.
You know, we all, everybody's got something going on, and we're all flooded with information all day long. So I don't expect, and I grew up in the nuclear freeze movement and at a time when this was the salient public issue. Yeah. We don't expect a groundswell of millions of Americans to march, right? But the only way this will change is if the public cares enough and communicates with their elected officials to take an interest in this. Congress has the dominant role in how many nuclear weapons we have, how much we're going to invest in them, and whether or not we're going to have treaties. And I will tell you from personal experience, I've gone into the room with a member of Congress who said, you know, I was at a public meeting and I had three people there who asked me about this nuclear issue. And they ended the whole meeting for what we were there to talk about because three constituents showed up at a town hall meeting and asked about this issue. It does capture people's attention. And so you don't need thousands of people to call their congressman. You need a few to actually care enough to show up. Now, to do that, they need information. That's one of the things we help provide, and one of the things you're helping to provide through this podcast and other people that do provide conduits of information are necessary. One of the organizations I'll shout out we work with called the Nuclear Threat Initiative. Go to their website, nti.org. It's great. They do great work. They did a study on where people get information about nuclear weapons issues. And interestingly, it wasn't Justice by Design podcast. It wasn't my old podcast, We're All Gonna Die. They get most of their information on nuclear from social media. And most of that social media is based on video games. Fallout.
Interesting.
Minecraft. So how do we use that knowledge to actually get good information in the hands of the public that might care about it? And actually, that broke down a lot of the class, economic, racial, political barriers, because everybody games. Yeah. Men, women, old people, young people, rich people, poor people. And so we try to use that information. But it is really hard. And we just have to recognize that it's never going to be millions of people, unless, God forbid, something terrible happens, which we all are working to make sure it doesn't. But it is a thorny problem and one we don't have the answer to.
John, is there any source of hope that we can end this discussion on? Because I am ready to start talking to my husband about building a fallout shelter in our home.
So don't waste the money. Fallout shelters aren't worth it. And okay. And neither is moving to Australia. There's always hope, right? I mean, I helped write a speech for Barack Obama called the Prague Speech from 2009, where he says, look, if we accept that nuclear weapons are always going to exist, then really we're tacitly saying that nuclear weapons are going to be used. And that's not how humanity can operate. So there is hope. We have gone 80 years without the use of a nuclear weapon because a lot of people have worked really hard to build in norms and procedures and codes of operating that prevented that from happening. But there are things that we can do about this. So, for example, the United States and Russia have a computerized hotline. It's actually not a phone that you call up and talk to Vlad or Don. It's a computer screen where we can not only send a message, but we know that the message is popping up in Russian on the other screen. That's very helpful. And we've used that over the years to make sure that we can get a message through in a crisis. And we test it actually every day. It's at the State Department. We don't have one with China. We should. We don't have one with India and Pakistan. We should. The United States and Russia and China all have a lot of satellites that do early warning detection. We should have a joint center where there are Americans, Russians, Chinese, Brits, French that staff that center, and they can all see each other's early warning data. So that if there's a false alarm, they can say, well, that's not true. That's not the way. So that's a very easy thing to do. So we have the tools to minimize these risks. We can't eliminate them until weapons go away or we get rid of them, but we can mitigate them. And that just takes good government work. I know government action right now isn't seen as very popular by the people in control of the government, but the government has protected Americans for 80 years under the nuclear sword and knows how to do this, but they have to be empowered to do it.
All right, John Wolfsthal, thank you so much for joining me and making me and my listeners smarter about this.
Thanks so much for having me, Kimberly.
And thanks to all of you for joining me this week for Justice by Design. If you're listening as a podcast, make sure that you follow it wherever you get your pods and give me a 5-star review because that helps this podcast grow. And you can also subscribe if you're watching this on YouTube to make sure you don't miss an episode. Thank you. Until next week, I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is Justice by Design.